The views and opinions expressed on the Timeless Voyager Series podcast are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the Timeless Voyager Series podcast or the host, Bruce Stephen Holmes.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Timeless Voyager, where the knowledge is timeless and you are the Voyager. I'm your host, Bruce Stephen Holmes. So buckle up, because today's ride promises to be a jarring one, to say the least. Today's guest is Dr. Mario Martinez, a clinical neuropsychologist who established the Biocognitive Science Institute in 1998. Now, he proposes, based on credible research evidence, that longevity is learned and the causes of health are inherited. For the past 25 years, he has studied healthy centenarians, that's people who are 100 years or older, and found that only 20 to 25% can be attributed to genetics. The rest is related to how they live and the cultural beliefs they share. This model suggests that higher numbers of centenarians will live healthier lives than cultures that view aging as a process of inevitable deterioration. In addition to longevity, he also lectures on why our immune system is not just a protector. Instead, he says it responds to the cultural premises we learn. Welcome to the show, Dr. Martinez.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you, Bruce.
All right. I actually, off the bat, want to ask you a question. Are you saying that a cultural belief may be responsible for the inevitable decline in health and longevity of specific age groups like seniors, including centenarians?
Yes, to a certain degree. There is some wear and tear that goes on, but most of it is the portals, what I call the portals that we put people in. And you begin to then live by the portal, which has very little to do with biology. I'll give you an example. If a culture says that middle age is 45, a day before you weren't middle age. You're 45 and you're middle age all of a sudden. Now you begin to dress middle age, think middle age, and get sick like the middle age. And if you try to get out of the middle age, you're admonished into, what do you think? For example, I'm wearing this Hollister, which is a shirt that people in their early 20s wear, and they say, what are you trying to do? You want to look like a teenager? They bring you back. You want to go back to school? They tell you, no, you really need to save your money so you can then retire. So they put you into that, and that is what most of the aging takes place. And we can go to the microbiological, we can go to the neuropsychological, which we can cover if you want to, but I believe that aging has a biological component. It's what's called inflammation. There's an inflammation process that goes on, but centenarians reverse that process, and that's why they don't get these kinds of illnesses that people get when they grow older, like diabetes type 2 and so forth. So we can go into it, and I'll give some really good science behind that. Yes, inflammation is the actual inflammatory process that goes on, but the people that do the research and in longevity, they call it inflammaging. Is what happens as you grow older, the inflammation process that goes on. So they call it inflammaging. But yes, inflammation is the actual molecules of inflammation going to fight a pathogen or an infection or just a process of deterioration that goes on.
So is it possible, for example, that something as simple as respect for older Americans can not only affect their overall health, but also increase the quality of the aging process?
Yes, very much, because we are what I call biosymbolic. And I'll give you an example. I came up with this questionnaire that we're going to be offering, which actually is 20 years of research of looking how centenarians view the world, what is their perception, and what is their emotions. Four perceptions, four emotions. And each one of them has either an anti-inflammatory or anti-stress component to it. This, I believe, is why they live so long. But let me give you an example. Just examples are the best way to explain a complex theory. Gratitude is one of the four emotions. And anytime that you are able to experience gratitude, you have oxytocin, which is a neuropeptide that's very good, including repairing heart tissue. It's excellent. It happens. It's a bonding. So if someone says to you, I love the presentation that you gave, you can accept that, and it has to finish with thank you very much. If you say thank you very much, you get oxytocin, serotonin, and all the other wonderful neurotransmitters. If you say, oh, anybody can do it, or no problem, or you don't say anything, you don't get the benefit. That's how powerful the psychoneuroimmunology of language is.
So basically what you're saying is that, and I'm probably repeating it, but the point here is that there's communication going on one way and non-communication the other way.
Yes, there's a consequence for every word you say. There's a, for example, in Japan and other countries in Asia, they have a different way of looking at menopause. Menopause in this country is a necessary evil. They have all kinds of names for it. People get depressed. Women lose their libido. They lose their self-esteem. Sometimes they gain weight. They get depressed, all these things. So you would think, okay, this is a hormonal process that's going on and there's nothing you can do. That's just a process in life. In some places in South America, they even go further and they call it the hot flashes. They call it bochorno, which means shame. Shame is an inflammatory emotion. They have more problems than other places. Now, you go to Japan, you go to China, especially in Japan, they call it konenki, which means the second spring or the second opportunity. They don't have any of these symptoms. In fact, in Japanese, there's no word for hot flashes. They call it hot flashes. It's that rare. So the culture will determine how you're going to interpret your biology. Ellen Langer, my colleague at Harvard, has done extensive work for 40 years on these kinds of things and pretty much supports what I'm doing. And I've done my work also clinically. She has looked at people. Diabetes type 2 is a physiological thing. You have a problem with glucose. So what she did is she had three groups of people who are diabetic, and they wanted to measure the glucose. That's very biological. But what they did is they had three conditions. One group, all three, they had them do a meaningless task, a 90-minute things of talking about themselves, whatever, just a meaningless task to do the measure. And then one group was put in a situation where they had a clock with real time, another had a clock with half as fast as real time, and the other one twice as fast as real time. And what they found is that the glucose was responding to the perceived time rather than to real time. That's what I call the biocognitive clock. That's amazing.
No, really, that's amazing. I mean, that is amazing. I mean, the point is that perception is everything.
Yes, and they did it with chronic pain. They did it with wound healing. Same thing. Is the perception that you create will tell the biology how to go to a certain degree, not 100%. But here it's very clearly stated that, okay, the glucose goes up. Why? Because we did a time-space projection. That's neuropsychologically, you do a time-space projection of what's going to happen, and your biology is influenced by that. With the pain, this is another study that was done. What they do is they have two groups of people, and they set them up to measure the actual receptors of pain, the physiological pain, and the subjective pain. They say, what is it on the, it's a subjective scale of pain from 1, nothing, 10, the worst you've ever had. One group, they tell them, we're going to shock you every 15 seconds for a minute. The other group, we're going to shock you every 15 seconds for 5 minutes. The brain makes a time-space projection, and they stop at 1 minute so they can measure both consistently and significantly. The one who believed that it was going to be 5 minutes, they have more physiological pain and more subjective pain.
So they were actually influenced.
Yes. The brain makes a time-space projection of what's going to happen. And the brain, if we could be anthropomorphic and say, okay, speak for the brain. All right, I can handle this amount of pain for 1 minute, but for 5 minutes, it's going to have to be more pain receptors that are going to have to be activated here. It's amazing.
I'm floored. Tell all of us, the people that are listening, what does... I actually go to my notes for a second. The term that you use for your company, biocognitive science.
Yes, biocognitive is a word that I coined because everyone understands you have to be in a cave to not believe that there's mind-body connection. And it's not mind over body or mind over matter. It's mind-body as one. but it was missing the cultural component. The mind just doesn't communicate in a vacuum with a brain, with a body. It communicates in a cultural context. So biocognition is mind-body culture. And that's what I'm bringing into science, the cultural component, the anthropology that was missing in psychoneuroimmunology.
In the Huffington Post article, I think it's called The Way of the Outlier, A Scientific Mystic or a Mystical Scientist. I want to know if you're suggesting that biocognition and mysticism, seemingly opposed models, can actually be valuable in serving humanity.
Well, I believe, and I didn't come up with the terms. I can't remember who it was. I wish I could give this person credit, but this person said, if you're a seeker in life, you're either a scientific mystic or a mystical scientist. And what I did is I put it into more operational terms. For example, Einstein was a mystical scientist. And what that means is that if you're a scientist and you use mysticism, I don't mean the woo-woo kind of things, but the metaphysical kinds of things that go on, then you inform your science with the things that can't be measured, the way to look at it. If the other way around, you inform your mysticism with the science that can be measured. There are things that can't be measured, and you could call it mysticism or you could call it contemplative, but it informs the science. And the other way, the science informs the things that are not measurable. You can't measure a thought. You can measure the effect of the thought. You can go to the neurotransmitters and you can see it in the functional MRI, but the thought itself is it's immeasurable. It cannot be measured. So you have to bring both together. And Einstein, the way that he discovered relativity was he had a dream that he was riding a rainbow. Think about that. What does that mean? When Jonas Salk came up with discovering the vaccine for polio, he pretended that he was a virus, and he acted like a virus to see how he could fight the virus. These are processes that are not measurable, but heuristically, they're very powerful for science.
That's really very, very interesting. People don't think of scientists that way, or at least I don't.
Right.
Let me follow up on a little bit of that with something I was looking into. Let's talk about the possibility that the way media portrays age in America may have a correlation with disease.
Well, we're informed by what I call cultural editors. Cultural editors are people that have power in a particular context. A teacher in a classroom, a priest in a church, a doctor in a clinic, very a lot of power because we're born with that design to be able to pay attention to a culture editor, our first culture editor, the mother. You're hungry, you go for the breast or you go for the bottle. So we're taught that. The media has a power of information and they give you information and most people take it. That's truth. That's how it is. And then the media and the pharmaceutical companies work together, not in any collusion or anything, but you know, they're trying to sell medication. And you get all these constantly, you get all kinds of ads, this person with diabetes, this person with cancer, this person with that, and then the medication they need constantly. And the implicit message there is, as you grow older, this is going to happen to you. And it's not that way at all, but it influences you. Because for example, if you give someone or yourself an interpretation of helplessness, if someone says, this is something that you can't do. Forget it. You're not going to be able to do it. Your body, your immune system goes into a sense of helplessness. Your natural killer cells decrease. These are the ones that fight cancer and all the kinds of pathogens. It decreases. When you're in the moment that you said to yourself or someone says to you, look, these are the resources to overcome the challenge, immediately you and your immune system get empowered. An example, research with rats. Rats don't have any placebo. Rats are just strictly reflex, although they have some cognition, but they don't have an awareness of their awareness. They put a rat in a situation that's called a no escape. They put him in a cage where they can't escape and they shock it. They can't escape. They shock it. They shock it. They shock it. There's no escape paradigm. Eventually, the rat gives up and no longer responds to the pain. What they're doing is they're secreting so much endorphins that it's actually anesthetizing them. At that point, their natural killer cells drop significantly. But now, if you teach, that's called physiological helplessness. But if you teach a rat to press a lever, and that lever or that light or whatever you give them stops the shock, they learn very quickly. And once they do that, have access to resources to overcome a challenge, natural killers go up, and they inject them with precancer cells. The ones that are helpless flares up. The ones that are not helpless fight the precancer cell. So, and that's what we do constantly, the helplessness.
So the bottom line is that we're being made helpless. The media yes. made us helpless. Well, and I see now I can actually say what I want to say here. There is collusion.
there is a kind of an implicate collusion. Yeah. Not that let's do this so we can trick the people, but what you're doing is benefiting my company. And the interesting thing about pharmaceuticals and the media is that they both work on the same premise, fear. If you don't do this, it's going to happen. And by the way, pharmaceuticals are wonderful in many cases of dealing with acute kinds of problems and keeping people alive. They're wonderful. I don't want to knock them. But some pharmaceuticals will play predator and will collude in a kind of a implicit way with media. And of course, it causes problems. So, yeah, I think that there's a lot of that. And centenarians, because they don't have access to a lot of doctors, they live in rural areas, they don't go to doctors that much. And I asked one, and I'm not saying you shouldn't go to doctors. I go to a doctor when I have a problem, but I don't go to over-doctoring. I asked one, when was the last time you went to a doctor? And he said, oh, about 75 years ago. I said, what happened? He said, I broke my leg, and the doctor went and fixed the leg and all that. Since then, I haven't been. Because I don't need to. I'm healthy. Why should I go to the doctor? And I asked him naively. I said, so what do your doctors have to say? And he said, I don't know. They're all dead. So that's the answer that I got from him. Now, I'm not suggesting that. What I'm saying is that sometimes we can get overdiagnosed, overtreated. And what happens is that then you get one medication, and then you get another medication for the side effect of the medication. I've had patients who come to me with 15 different medications. So I work with a psychiatrist. I'm a clinical neuropsychologist. I work with a psychiatrist to work with the medication to get them to a point where they need the least amount, and we do the most amount to replace what the medication can do, but always with a physician involved.
Let's talk about your novel, The Man from Autumn. I'll show a picture of the book because that's a cool looking, a nice little picture there. I'll bring that up.
The Man from Autumn was the most fun, and it's got a lot of science in it. What I did is I thought, okay, how can I get my theory for people to learn to live the theory in a novel? So I created these characters who are living biocognition. For example, I look at love. One couple falls in love in their 30s. They're both in their 30s. One couple falls in love, and the man is much more older than the woman. And the third couple, they fall in love in their 70s. To look at what is the common denominator of love. And then I was doing a lot of work with stigmata, how people, very rare, people who have they show the wounds of Christ and they don't heal, and there's spontaneous healing around them. It's mostly Catholic. So the main character is investigating stigmata for the Vatican. So there's a lot of autobiographical work there. The book has a lot of good food, a lot of good wine. It has very, very good science behind stigmata and very good science behind longevity, but in a way that you're actually telling a story. So it was a lot of fun, but I brought the science that's there is real. The fiction and science are coming together to give you a kind of a textbook for you to practice biocognition.
So this is why you say that it's a navigational mindscape for the private journey of self. And that's self with a capital S, incidentally.
Yes, exactly. It's a navigational process. The private journey of self, nobody can live it for you. For example, Plato said there are two things that nobody can do for you: die for you or make meaning in your life. That's yours. Nobody can do that. And that's exactly right. So you have to be in tune with what your end is. You have to be in tune with what your meaning is. And what are you going to contribute while you're here?
I feel like I'm getting all the knowledge I was looking for.
Thank you. Well, now, one good thing that I want to tell your audience, that it's the first that I've done in English with you, mm-hmm. is that we have developed a questionnaire, which will be free for the first 1,000 people, that actually will show you how close you are to centenarian consciousness and how to learn to be like centenarians. And then we're going to correlate that with the most exact biological measures and markers of your biological age, what's called glycan age. These people have published over 300 articles in the best journals, the most exact way that they can find out, because they look at inflammation in the immune system. Then we have a correlation, and we'll tell you, look, your biological age is 10 years younger, 10 years older. This is how it relates to our questionnaire, and this is what you can do to reverse your biological age. And we have a pilot study going now with 50 centenarians. We're giving them the CCI, which is the Centenarian Consciousness Index, my questionnaire, and we're giving them the glycan age. And what we're finding is that on the average, and this is what we were predicting, centenarians are 20 years younger than their chronological age. What's going on? The way they live. Genetics, 20%.
It's amazing. I don't want to be forcing you to move too fast here, and you can let me know if I am, but why don't we talk a little bit about the bestseller?
In the Mind-Body Code, I'm introducing my theory and practice, clinical practice and theory from mind-body culture. There, I have chapters on forgiveness, the physiology and the neuropsychology and the emotional process of forgiveness. I talk about centenarians, what I learned from centenarians. I talk about what I call guardians of the heart, which is relationships, archetypal wounds that we bring. And since it's a new language and a new paradigm, each chapter has applications, actual applications that you do once you read this chapter. It has a glossary to go to all those weird words that I come up with, and has an extensive bibliography for people who want to look at the science. That's a book that really brings together biocognition in a way that people can actually put it to use. I first teach the words, and then I say, okay, now this is what it means, and this is how you can apply it to your life. So once you read the book, you have a really good understanding of mind-body science and what you can do about your life as far as relationships and as far as being able to accept good fortune, low self-esteem. When you have low self-esteem and something good happens to you, it's a stress response. It's like watching a lion, because you're not worthy of that. So we look at that. And so it's a good book. And I think it was published in 2014, and it's been a bestseller on and off all this time. But good book.
All right. I came across a couple ideas here, and I don't understand them very well, but I'm going to ask the question. Could you comment on plasticity in the brain and the idea that plasticity is not an occasional state of the nervous system, but rather it's an ongoing state? I had a sneaking suspicion this is about something that I don't understand, but it talks to me for some reason. So let me hear what you have to say.
Okay, now I get out of the anthropologist. I have to be the neuropsychologist now.
Okay.
The plasticity is a way that the brain can adapt to trauma, to consequences, negative. And the way that it's set up that way, it's called a redundancy. If you have, for example, brain damage in a particular part of the brain that affects your speech, there are other areas of the brain that pick up on that and compensate for that, so that you can, the redundancy means that the information is in many, many places in case, because of the evolution, in case one area is damaged, then the other area can come and can compensate. And then that's how you can teach people to speak again when they lost their speech or their motor skills. But I'll give you one that has to do with the healthy brain so you can see the plasticity. There's some research that was done at Harvard where this neuroscientist looked at people who were learning to teach the blind. They had to learn Braille, and but they wanted them to actually feel how it is to be blind. So what he did, what's called the visual cortex, the occipital area of the brain, has to do with vision. It goes from the eyes all the way down to the occipital area, and then comes right back, and that's what vision is. So what they did is they blindfolded the teachers for 6 weeks. It takes that long for the brain to do the re reforming and reformulating and all that for 6 weeks. That's the occipital lobe, which has to do, remember, with vision. So before that, they would show them things like, for example, a flower, and you're looking at a flower, and that's visual, and the occipital code, the lobe would activate. Okay, so then after 6 weeks, they showed them the same things, and the occipital code lobe was not responding. It was like the blind. What it did is began to respond to the tactile things like the blind, no longer to the visual, and they had to relearn again. Very quickly, they relearned it, how that works. So that's the best example of plasticity that I can give you.
That must have been awfully scary for the people that were trying to become teachers. Because first of all, and I only know this because I for a long time, was assisting a family where the husband and wife were both blind. And it was like a whole learning experience that I really am very happy that I was involved in. But it was tough, and I became so aware of everything around me that one of the reasons that they kept me on, not because I'm special or anything, but because I began to talk about the surroundings. I began to describe the rooms we were in and what the colors were and everything, and they said that they had not had that experience with other people. I know why, because when you're assisting somebody like that, you spend all of your time, you know, moving them around and talking for them and all these things, and you get completely lost in that, and you forget that there's an entire thing that they can't experience at all. Okay, so the point I'm making is that was my experience, but that's the reverse of what you're talking about. These people were, that was taken away from them, and then when they were allowed to be able to see again, the lobe. What's it called? The occipital lobe?
The occipital lobe, yeah.
Yeah, was not responding right away. And that would have scared the hell out of me, because you start thinking that you're blind or something, you can't do it.
Well, they could see the flowers,
right?
But they could see them from a different part of the brain, not from the occipital code.
You scared me and think, I always thought, okay.
No, they could still see it, but the brain was already... The plasticity already happens. That, okay, if you're not using this, we're going to turn it into tactile. That's why people who with one loss of sense go into another. And one of the things that I used to do when I was working in neuropsychology rehab, I would first identify what was the mode that this person had of this five senses, which is the one that there were some people are more visual, some people are more tactile. And once we found that, we did compensatory techniques to teach them how to function. If they were visual, we used the visual to help them with the motors, for example, in back and forth. But that's the plasticity, and that's extremely important. That took a couple of million years to develop. So it's better than the Apple model. It doesn't need any updates.
So just to kind of like go through a little bit of let's just call it a refresher or something. So you're saying that longevity is culturally learned, and also the cause of health issues. Is that correct?
The causes of health, I believe, are inherited.
Yeah.
And I believe to a certain degree, longevity is learned. And let me explain that.
Yeah.
that's a pretty, as I used to say, the hippies used to say, that's pretty heavy, man. let me unheavy it.
Right.
We, as modern Homo sapiens, we've been around for 150,000 years. As anything that resembles a human, 2 million years. But let's say 20,000 years, which is when our consciousness and our language began. We have been going with trial and error. This works here, that works there. When you have an infection here, that works there. So you're learning the causes of health to keep you healthy. And the body is constantly trying to keep you healthy. But they need to be triggered. They need to be triggered with the things that we're talking about here. You have the potential for the causes of health, but they need to be triggered with the emotions and the perceptions that I'm talking about. Why do I say that longevity is learned? Because if longevity is only 20%, what we're getting is either what you're learning yourself in the environment and epigenetics, which is another area that's very important. Epigenetics is the actual learning that you have and that you pass on to other people. Example, people that have been in concentration camps in Auschwitz and other places, they pass on the potential for high cortisol for five generations. So epigenetics is not a DNA transfer. It's a transfer of how the genes are going to be expressed. So you have epigenetic transfer and you have experience. And whatever you're experiencing, you're going to pass on epigenetically to your kids as well as your genetic, which would be the DNA. So given that, then you have tremendous opportunity to learn longevity, which is what we're doing. My work is to teach people longevity. So it turns upside down the conventional thinking of gerontology, which actually studies the illnesses of aging. We study the causes of health in the process of growing older. Totally different paradigm.
And just to kind of go back on that for a second, I'm underlining the word cortisol. What do you mean by that? I know what cortisol is, but maybe you could just expound on that for a moment.
All right. Cortisol is one of the hormones of stress. And usually if you have a stress reaction, you don't get cortisol right away. You get adrenaline or adrenaline. Like if you got something hot, you move. That's not cortisol. That's the adrenaline or adrenaline working with the nervous system. Later, it takes a while, but cortisol comes on later, which is another. And it's good. It's necessary for all kinds of things, but it's not good when it's chronic. So what happened is that the people who survived Auschwitz were in, obviously in a very chronic, stressful situation. They didn't know if they were going to live the next day. So they had to create a psychoneuroimmunology of stress, 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 stress. So the body got used to living in stress. You wake up in the morning, you have the cortisol high, you have blood pressure high. And so you're passing on that propensity to the next generation and the next generation. I worked with one adolescent who was a fourth generation Auschwitz, and he had high cortisol and they couldn't figure out what was going on. They gave him medication, they did that. We started working with some techniques that I use for this kind of epigenetic problem. And the cortisol started coming out within 6 to 8 weeks. It just went back to normal.
Now, you mentioned, and you mentioned type 2 diabetes a number of times. Is there a correlation there also?
Well, this is a correlation, not a cause.
Right.
The three archetypal wounds that I identified, just like with centenarians, there are three ways that the culture can hurt you, culture editors, to keep you within for your own good or not so much for your own good. You can either be betrayed, you can be shamed, or you can be abandoned. Those are the three archetypal wounds. And I call them archetypal because I see them in every culture. Now, when we look at the immune system and what does that mean, if you are abandoned, you're going to have a hypoimmunity. You have a low immunity, and there's a propensity, not a cause, for infections and cancer and things that have to do with the underimmunity, not a cause, correlation. Shame is the one that's been studied the most. Shame causes inflammation. The moment that you're shamed, you're going to have tumor necrosis factor molecules, and you're going to have C-reactive protein and inflammation, and it doesn't know where to go. There's a correlation there with autoimmune illnesses. Doesn't mean it's caused. And one of the things that we're looking into is type 2 diabetes, which is an autoimmune, how that correlates with the shaming components of it. Obviously, even if it's not related, it doesn't help to have shame if you have an autoimmune illness, because you're creating more inflammation in addition to what the immune system does. And one of the theories is that you're sending signals of a battle, and there's no battle there. You're sending inflammation. After a while, the immune system begins to get confused, and it begins to then attack itself in a way. That's a theory, but that's one of the things that we're looking into, that inflammation is good if you have something to be inflamed about. But it's not good if it's an inflammation, there's nothing there.
Is this similar to the study with the rats that you're talking about?
Yeah. The shame causes, and it's very interesting because it's cultural. To shame someone in the United States, you have to shame the person. Or, of course, it'd be the family, but basically the person. That's when you have especially in the tumor necrosis factor, which has been studied the most. If you go to Asia, the shaming happens if you shame the family, the business, the country, because the individual is not as important as the collectivism. But once you shame, The immune system says, let me wait to see what the culture says. You're shamed. Okay, I'm going to shoot out these kinds of things. The immune, nervous, and endocrine system.
So this point that I brought up before is kind of like a question was how this affects, or let's say how media is affecting the possible health of the country and the, well, not just the health, then of course the wealth of the country. This is something that is very serious. This is not just.
It is. And there's good media out there that puts out good information. The media that I've worked with who are actually doing documentaries on the centenarians and the things that we come up, that's good. That's good information that you have. It's information. What you do with it is up to you. And this is why newspapers are dying. People are tired of that. Now, of course, moving on to the digital world. But yes, you're being, I don't watch, when I want a detox and I want to do a cleansing of my thoughts, I don't watch the news for a week. And I notice tremendous difference in how I feel and how, and then I'm dumb enough, I go back to find out what it is because, you know, I'm imperfect like everybody else. So I want to find out what's going on. But you don't want to do the media. You don't want to do a media obsession because it's bad for your health. The nerve, the body doesn't know. If you're eating, for example, this is very important. I work with Fortune 100 centenarians in my head, CEOs, and many of them have gastrointestinal problems. Why? We have two systems in the nervous system. We have the sympathetic and the parasympathetic. The sympathetic is what I'm doing now. Sympathetic is action. We're focused on an external thing going on, and it's activating everything except the digestion. The parasympathetic is the opposite. The opposite, which when digestion starts and you're eating, it slows down everything and it speeds up the digestion. But look what happens if you're eating and you're eating with your iPhone watching something negative. You're going sympathetic, parasympathetic, back and forth. You're teaching your system indigestion, you're teaching your system IBS, all kinds of things by what you're doing against your nature. Your nature is if we're going to eat, you eat. If you're going to do work with your computer, you do it after you eat. You don't do it together. And a lot of people think that multitasking is good. A lot of studies show that it's not only inefficient, but it's bad for your health.
Wow. I mean, my wife and I generally sit and watch TV while we're eating. And then the worst part about it is it's YouTube. So I'm picking out the things that are going to annoy me the most.
Yeah, no, of course. Because look, the brain doesn't know the difference between cognition knows. Cognition knows that you're watching a rape, but the brain doesn't know you're watching a rape. So it has all kinds of expressions of fight or flight. And if you do that every time you eat, you're confusing the system. So I don't eat with phones. I don't watch anything. You know what I would do? You and your wife, if you drink wine, have a nice wine, candle lit, and explore each other. That is one of the causes of health, by the way. Breaking bread with people you love is one of the causes of health.
Before we wrap this thing up, I want to say that this has been much more than I could have ever planned on. And I want to thank you for appearing and doing the work you've done. This is very important work. I hope that people that are watching this have maybe watch it a few times. It's excellent, excellent information. If you wanted to do a little bit of a wrap up yourself, would you like to do that now?
Sure, sure. What I want to emphasize is that we have tremendous power to bring health or to bring hell to our bodies and our mind. It's not magical. It's not, you don't think yourself into things. You have to mind body yourself. So for example, affirmations don't work on their own. If you say, I'm wonderful, I'm healing, that doesn't work. The brain needs evidence. If you go back and you say, I'm wonderful, you sit quietly, I'm wonderful. And then you go back to evidence of when you were wonderful, embody it and experience it. Do it three or four times, and then for the rest of the week, do things that give you evidence that you're wonderful. That works. That has a powerful psychoneuroimmunological effect.
Well, this has been great. You're a great guest.
Thank you. And thank you for your work, the work that you're doing.
I certainly stumbled around a lot today, but that's just because this was so important to me, and my notes were not as good as they probably could have been, but your material is so deep, and I was really, I really enjoyed it. And of course, I stumbled on a lot of the terms, and I was questioning whether I was the right person to do this in the first place. But
no, you are. And everyone that interviews me for the first time has that reaction, because it's a new paradigm, and it has to shock you, because new information comes when there's uncertainty. So you have to have uncertainty to learn. If you would have said, I got everything and everything's fine, I have no questions, you wouldn't have gotten it.
Thank you for watching and listening to the Timeless Voyager series podcast. You know, we're on video players like YouTube, Rumble, and audio players like Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Chrome Browser, and many more. One thing you can do to support the growth of Timeless Voyager is to hit that like button, share, and of course, comment. And a lot of the information you've heard today, I will put in the description below so that you can find and locate this phenomenal work that we listened to today with Dr. Martinez. The most important thing you can do, of course, is to subscribe. My next milestone is 1,000 subscribers, which doesn't sound like a lot to some people, but, you know, we're we're small. You can help by just hitting the subscribe button below in the description. Subscribing is free, and it helps to grow the Timeless Voyager channel. My name is Bruce Stephen Holmes. I hope that your own personal voyage through life towards the development of your highest potential is a joyous and successful one.